I want you to do something for me. Open up your phone, scroll through your news feed, check the financial headlines. What's the vibe you get?
It's panic. It is almost always panic. Inflation is sticky. Our recession is looming. The stock market is volatile. The tech bubble is bursting.
Exactly. It feels fragile. Living in the economy day to day feels like riding a roller coaster in the dark. You are just bracing for the next drop.
Right.
But I've been looking at the research we're covering today, specifically this chapter on stylized facts, and it suggests that my anxiety is, well, misplaced.
Misplaced, or perhaps just too zoomed in.
Right. Because the premise of this deep dive is that if you stop looking at the economy from the ground level, where all the noise is, and you go up to 30,000 feet, that roller coaster just disappears.
It vanishes.
And what you are left with is something that looks suspiciously like a straight line.
That is the core of what we are talking about today. We are looking at the neoclassical framework. It's the lens economists use to strip away the daily chaos and look at the engine underneath.
And when you do that,
And when you look at the U.S. economy through this lens, you find these stylized facts, these rules that have held true for over a century.
and some of them are incredibly weird. We're going to talk about magic numbers that stay constant for 100 years, a mathematical proof that implies our greed and our laziness cancel each other out perfectly.
And maybe a red flag that suggests this whole stable system might actually be breaking down right now.
It's a fascinating mix of history, math, and psychology.
It really is.
So let's start with the big picture, the bird's eye view. We have this chart in the source material, Figure 2.1. It tracks U.S. GDP per capita, so output per person, from the mid-1800s to today.
Right?
Now, usually when I look at a chart covering 150 years, I expect to see chaos.
You expect jagged lines, absolutely.
Yeah. I expect to see the Great Depression looking like a cliff. I expect World War II to look like a mountain. But this chart, it's a ruler. It is a straight line sloping upward.
This is what's known as the log scale view of growth. And it reveals something pretty profound. The U.S. economy has grown at a real rate of about 1.8 to 2% per year, every year, for more than a century.
But let's challenge that for a second. We know the Great Depression happened. Unemployment was 25%. You can't tell me that doesn't show up on the chart.
Oh, it shows up. But on a century-long scale, it looks like a small dip, a hiccup. But here's the part that usually blows people's minds. Look at what happens immediately after the Depression and after World War II.
The line goes almost vertical. It shoots up.
Exactly. The economy didn't just recover to where it was, it accelerated. It grew faster than average until it caught up to the exact same trend line it was on in 1890.
That is the part I was struggling to wrap my head around. It's like the economy has a GPS destination set, and if it gets forced off the road by a war or a crash,
It speeds up to get back on schedule.
and once it hits the line, it just puts on the cruise control again.
That is stylized fact number one, the unstoppable march of output. It implies that while politicians and policies affect the short-term wiggles, the long-run trajectory is driven by something much deeper, something structural.
Okay, so if output is this steady heartbeat, let's look at what's driving it. This brings us to stylized fact number two, and this is where the numbers start to feel a little bit spooky, the capital output ratio.
Right. Capital meaning the stuff we use to make other stuff, machines, factories, computers, office buildings.
And the output is GDP. The source material highlights Figure 2.2, which shows the ratio between the total value of all our machines and the total value of our annual output. And for nearly 100 years, that number has hovered right around three.
It is incredibly stable.
Walk me through why that's weird. Because think about the technological shift from, say, 1920 to 2024. We went from steam engines and basic assembly lines to server farms and AI.
A completely different world.
You would think that as we get more high tech, we would need way more capital to produce things. Or maybe way less because computers are so efficient. Why doesn't this ratio drift up to 10 or down to 1? Why 3?
It was a massive puzzle for early economists. It suggests there is a specific recipe to the U.S. economy. No matter the technology, the value of the capital stock needed to generate $1 of income tends to settle at $3.
But I need to push back on this because I've read other economists, like Thomas Piketty. He wrote that massive book on inequality, capital in the 21st century. And he argued that the capital-to-income ratio is skyrocketing, that it's going from 4 to 5 to 6.
Right.
Is he wrong, or is this source wrong?
Well, they are using different definitions, and the distinction is crucial for understanding the economy. Piketty talks about wealth. This source talks about productive capital.
Okay, what's the difference?
Wealth includes land and, most importantly, housing. If you look at the last 40 years, housing prices have just exploded. So if you count houses as capital, then yes, the ratio is skyrocketing.
Yeah.
But a house doesn't help you manufacture more widgets. It's an asset, but it's not a productive input in the, you know, factory sense.
So my house going up in value makes my wealth ratio go up. But it doesn't change the underlying mechanics of how the country produces goods.
Precisely. When you strip out the housing boom and just look at the equipment and structures used to run the economy, that ratio is flat. It stays at 3.
So despite all the innovation, the amount of machine power required to generate a dollar of GDP is structurally constant. That's wild.
It creates a very predictable baseline for growth models.
Okay, let's complicate this. We have stable output. We have stable capital ratios. But we know for a fact that life is getting more expensive and businesses are always trying to cut costs. This brings us to the price of money and labor. Stylized facts 3 and 4.
This is the tension between Main Street and Wall Street.
Here is the puzzle I saw in the data. Real wages, what I can actually buy with my paycheck, have gone up steadily. They basically track that same 2% growth line we talked about.
They do.
But the return on capital, the profit you make by owning a machine or investing in the stock market, is flat.
The economists call it stationary. Figure 2.4 shows stock market returns fluctuating wildly year to year, obviously, but average them out over decades, it's a flat line, no upward trend.
So walk me through the logic here. If I'm a business owner, labor is getting more expensive every single year, but the cost of capital, the cost of renting money or buying a machine, stays the same relative to output.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I hire anyone?
Why not just automate everything?
Exactly. If humans are expensive and robots are cheap, why don't I just fire the humans and buy robots?
That is the trillion-dollar question. It is the fear behind every automation panic in history. And the data shows that firms do that to some extent. The amount of capital per worker has gone up.
Sure.
You are working with way more expensive equipment than your grandfather did.
Right. I'm recording this on a laptop that costs way more than a 1950s typewriter.
But, and here's the key, you haven't been replaced by the laptop. You are using it. The neoclassical framework, specifically the work of Robert Salow, explains this with a concept called diminishing marginal returns.
We hear that term a lot, diminishing returns. But what does it actually look like in this context?
So imagine an accountant. Give her one computer, she becomes incredibly productive. She can do spreadsheets, email, tax software. That first unit of capital adds massive value.
Okay, makes sense.
Now give her a second computer. Maybe she uses it for a backup screen or to check stocks. It adds some value, but not as much as the first one. Now give her a third computer.
It's just taking up desk space.
Exactly. It might actually get in the way. The marginal product of that third computer is near zero. This is why firms don't just replace everyone with machines.
Right.
You can't just stack up capital indefinitely because eventually the machines stop adding value without humans to run them, maintain them, and interpret them.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But it raises a huge problem for growth. If we hit this wall of diminishing returns where the machines stop adding value, shouldn't the economy flatline? How do we keep growing at 2%?
That brings us to the hero of the story. The only reason we aren't stagnant, technology, but specifically what economists call labor-augmenting technological change.
Labor-augmenting. I like that. It sounds like Iron Man suits, not Terminators.
That is a perfect analogy. The model assumes that we aren't just inventing machines that do the work for us. We are inventing ways to make us more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
We're upgrading the software, improving logistics, raising education levels. The technology multiplies the effectiveness of the human hour.
This leads to my favorite term in the entire document. The Salow residual.
Ah, yeah.
Sounds like a spy thriller. The Salow residual. But the source calls it the measure of our ignorance. Can you unpack that?
It's a rare moment of humility from economists. When Robert Salow developed this model in the 1950s, he ran the math. He accounted for how much growth came from adding more machines, so capital, and how much came from adding more workers or labor.
And it didn't add up.
It didn't add up. There's a huge chunk of growth left over, the residual. And he realized that this leftover chunk was actually the most important part. It represents total factor productivity, or TFP.
The secret sauce.
Exactly. It's innovation, it's better management, it's the rule of law, it's efficiency. It's everything that lets us get more output from the same inputs. And looking at figure 2.9, that residual grows at a little under 2% a year.
So the majority of our prosperity isn't because we're building more factories, it's because we're getting smarter at using them.
Correct. The residual is the engine of the modern world.
Now, before we move on to how hard we're working, I have to ask about this sidebar in the notes, the Cambridge controversy. It seems like a massive academic beef from the 1950s that this source just casually drops in.
Oh, it's legendary in economic circles.
It was Cambridge, UK versus Cambridge, Massachusetts, MIT. What were they fighting about?
They were fighting about whether capital is even a real number. The British economist John Robinson and others argued that you can't just add up a blast furnace, a delivery truck, and a laptop and call it aggregate capital.
Okay.
They said it's mathematically impossible to put a single price tag on that pile because the price depends on interest rates, which depend on capital. It's a circular logic.
So they were saying the American model was built on fake math.
Essentially. And the funny thing is, the British side won the theoretical argument. They proved the American model was logically flawed.
We're still using the American model. We just spent 10 minutes discussing the capital output ratio.
Because the Americans won the practical argument. The MIT economists like Salo and Samuelson basically said, look, the math might be messy theoretically, but the model predicts the data perfectly. It works. So the entire profession just sort of agreed to ignore the theoretical hole and keep using the tool because it was useful.
It works well enough is the most American response possible.
I love it. Okay, let's pivot to the humans in this equation. Stylized fact number 7 is about labor supply. And honestly, this one confused me the most.
Why is that?
Because the data says that since World War II, the average hours worked per person in the U.S. has been flat, stationary. But everyone I know feels like they're working all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We have email on our phones. We're always on.
That feeling is real, but the data captures the aggregate across the whole population. You have to look at the timeline.
Yeah.
In the early 1900s, we worked 60-hour weeks. That dropped massively until roughly 1940.
Okay.
Since then, it's hovered around a steady average.
But that seems irrational to me. We just established that we are way richer than we were in 1940. Our wages are higher. Why haven't we bought our freedom? Why aren't we working 15-hour weeks and sipping mojitos?
Or flip it around. If wages are so high, why aren't we working 80 hours a week to buy 3 Ferraris?
True. We're doing neither. We're stuck in the middle. This is the battle between two massive economic forces, the income effect and the substitution effect.
Walk me through the logic of those.
The substitution effect is about opportunity cost. It says, hey, your hourly wage is high. Every hour you spend watching Netflix costs you $50 in lost wages. That's expensive TV. You should get off the couch and work.
That's the greed voice or the hustle voice.
Right. But the income effect is the leisure voice.
Mm-hmm.
It says, hey, look at your bank account. You're already rich compared to your grandparents. You can afford to take a break. You should buy some free time.
So greed versus leisure.
And the fact that U.S. work hours have stayed perfectly flat for 70 years implies something incredible. It means those two massive forces have canceled each other out exactly.
That feels like a cosmic coincidence.
It does. And for the math of these macro models to work, economists actually have to plug in a very specific equation for human happiness, what they call log utility.
What does that mean?
It implies that as humans, our desire for more stuff grows at the exact same rate as our desire for more free time.
So my internal struggle between I want a promotion and I want a nap is literally the cornerstone of macroeconomic stability.
It is. If our brains worked any other way, if the income effect was slightly stronger, we would have all quit working as soon as we got indoor plumbing. The economy would have collapsed from its own success.
I want to zoom out again. We've got these stable ratios, output, capital, hours worked. But why does the economy stay on this track? We mentioned earlier that after a disaster, like a war, the economy snaps back. What is the mechanism? Is it just luck?
It's not luck, it's convergence. Think of it like a speed limit.
A speed limit, okay.
Imagine a war destroys half the country's factories. It sounds terrible. But in economic terms, the remaining factories are now incredibly valuable. Scarcity drives up returns.
Right.
If you have the only truck left in the city, that truck is a gold mine.
Right, so investing in a new truck is a no-brainer. The profit margin is huge.
Exactly. The marginal product is high. So capital floods in, the economy grows at breakneck speed, far faster than that 2% average. Think about Germany or Japan after WWII. Their growth rates were insane.
But it doesn't last forever.
No. As you rebuild, as you get more trucks and more factories, the returns start to normalize. The easy money is gone. Growth slows down. Eventually, you settle back into that comfortable, steady 2% cruise.
The balanced growth path.
That is the balanced growth path.
So the economy has a natural equilibrium. If you go below it, the high returns pull you up. If you try to go above it, diminishing returns pull you back down.
Exactly. As long as the country keeps saving and investing a consistent chunk of its income, which the U.S. has, roughly 25-30%, you will always drift back to that line.
Okay, I was feeling very reassured. The system works, the lines are straight, the plane is on autopilot.
Yeah.
But looking at the end of the source material, I feel a but coming.
There is a but. A big one. We've been talking about stylized facts, things that have been true for a century, but recently one of those facts has started to wobble.
Which one?
Fact number 6, the labor share of income.
This is how we slice the pie, right?
Yeah.
How much of the GDP goes to workers versus how much goes to the owners of the capital?
Correct. For decades, this was the most boring number in economics. It was constant. About 2/3 of the pie went to labor and wages, and 1/3 went to capital and profits.
Huh.
It didn't matter if we were farming or building cars. The split was the same.
Then now.
Since the 1980s, that rule has broken. The labor share is declining, not just in the U.S., but globally. You can see it in figures 2.33 and 2.14. The line is drifting down.
So the owners are getting a bigger slice and the workers are getting a smaller slice.
Yes. And this is a big deal because the standard model, the Cobb-Douglas production function that every econ student learns, assumes this share is constant. If that assumption breaks, we have to rethink a lot of our understanding of who benefits from growth.
Why is it happening? If the model was perfect for 100 years, what changed in 1980?
That is the subject of a massive fight in economics right now. Some say it's automation, that maybe robots are actually replacing people this time, unlike in the past.
Mm.
Some say it's the death of unions and workers losing bargaining power. Some say it's the rise of superstar firms, companies like Google or Apple that make billions with relatively few employees.
It feels like a crack in the foundation. Like the autopilot's still on, but the engine is making a funny noise.
It definitely warns us that the stability we took for granted might not be guaranteed. If the labor share keeps dropping, the social contract of growth benefits everyone starts to unravel.
Yeah.
It suggests that while the size of the pie grows predictably, the slicing of the pie is changing.
So let's bring this in for a landing. We've unpacked a century of data. We've seen that the U.S. economy is surprisingly predictable. Output grows at 2%. Capital stays at 3x output. Wages rise with productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And it all hinges on us getting smarter with technology and balancing our greed with our leisure.
That's the summary. But I think the so what here is crucial. Understanding these baselines is a superpower. When you see a terrifying headline about a recession or a market crash, you can look at the long-run chart and realize this is likely just noise around the trend line.
It keeps you sane.
It keeps you sane. Yeah. It keeps you from overreacting.
But it also acts as a warning system.
Exactly. If those fundamental ratios, like the labor share, start to shift permanently, then the past 100 years of data might not predict the next 100. We can't just blindly trust the line. We have to watch the dashboard.
I want to leave the listener with one final thought, and this one comes from the very end of the source material. It's a philosophical requirement for this whole system to work. It's about why we save money.
Ah, the dynastic assumption.
The text mentions that for this balanced growth path to work mathematically, for us to save enough to keep the capital stock growing, we have to act as if we are going to live forever.
Right, because if you knew the world was ending when you died, you'd spend every penny you had on your last day. You wouldn't leave any machines for the next generation.
So the model assumes we care about our children and our grandchildren exactly as much as we care about ourselves. We have to have an infinite horizon.
That is a heavy assumption. We are assuming human altruism is the fuel for the economy.
So here's the provocative question. What happens if we stop being dynastic?
If we stop caring about the next lineage.
Exactly. If our generation decides, you know what, the future is uncertain, climate change, AI, whatever, I'm just going to spend it all now. I don't care about the great-grandkids. If we start saving for that distant future, does this whole beautiful straight line of economic growth just unravel?
It's possible. We might be living on the accumulated momentum of past altruism. If that runs out, the math changes.
Something to think about the next time you decide whether to put that money in a 401k or book a flight to Cabo. Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.
See you next time.